Alexis Burgess is a professor of philosophy at Stanford University. He is the author of the book titled Truth, which is part of the Princeton Foundations of Contemporary Philosophy. In this interview and discussion, he addresses why he adheres to a deflationary theory of truth, truth in semantics and philosophy of language, as well as the positive and negative attributes regarding a variety of theories concerning truth. Alexis, give us a very quick general overview of truth in philosophy.
Nowadays, there are two leading theories of truth in analytic philosophy, which I think Simon talked a little bit about in his interview, correspondence theory and deflationism. And correspondence theory is probably the most popular theory of truth among philosophers at large, but I think deflationism may be more popular, at least as popular, among philosophers of language in particular. That's obviously an empirical statistical claim that I'm not going to try to back up. The correspondence theory is sort of the main realist theory of truth. On some versions, it says that what it is for something to be true, whether it's a belief or a claim or a judgment, is for it to correspond to reality in the right way, whatever exactly that means. The deflationist thinks there's probably not a very informative way to spell out exactly what that means. And so all there is to the property of truth or our concept of truth is something as seemingly trifling as the equivalence between claiming that something is true on the one hand and simply asserting that thing on the other. So, for example, an instance of this general equivalence would be the claim that 2 + 2 = 4 is true, just in case, if and only if, 2 + 2 = 4. So those are the two main theories that people are working with nowadays. And we can go on to talk about some of their features and flaws. But I guess more historically, people sometimes think of pragmatism as another leading theory of truth on all fours with correspondence theory and deflationism. There's also this view associated with Peirce called pragmaticism, which is sort of like the idea that truth is just whatever we'll all agree upon at the hypothetical ideal limit of inquiry, which is sort of a nice thought that the various people have tried to make sense of over the years, Hilary Putnam included, and Crispin Wright with his sort of epistemic theory of truth as super assertability or something with a very, very high degree of justification behind it.
So before I get you to go into what you feel are the best and the worst attributes of some of these theories in truth, you've already touched upon one important talking point, and that would be truth in realism and perhaps the difficulties that truth encounters in anti-realism. Can an anti-realist say there is some kind of objective truth mapped out in terms of correspondence theory to reality? That would probably be more problematic, seeing that they think that truth is something that you can't necessarily get at, even with provable scientific theory. So is truth simply demarcated between a realist and an anti-realist? Is it that clear-cut?
That's a really good question. I mean, the relationship between the philosophical literature on truth and the philosophical literature on the so-called realism, anti-realism debates is really complicated and vexed for various reasons. So one useful exercise, and this project has sort of been carried out by Michael Devitt in his book, Realism and Truth. One useful exercise is to sort of see how much of the realism, anti-realism debates you can intuitively recover without helping yourself to the notion of truth. So, I mean, at the outset, you might think scientific realism or realism about ordinary medium-sized material objects, those are views like this. The relevant entities exist, and they exist independently of us, independently of our thought and talk about those entities. Now, on its face, that gloss on what realism amounts to, and therefore, by negation, what anti-realism amounts to, doesn't essentially seem to have anything to do with truth or falsity themselves. Though, of course, if you try to unpack this independence condition, the idea that the realist thinks that the objects exist independently of us, you may end up invoking representational notions like truth or reference or whatnot. So I guess I've come to think that there's a large chunk of what's at stake between realists and anti-realists in philosophy of science or philosophy of mathematics or meta-ethics that can be salvaged without without invoking the notion of truth and falsity, without complicating an already complicated debate by bringing those concepts to bear on it. Now, of course, that said, this is, I should come out of the closet. This is exactly the sort of thing you would expect a deflationist about truth to say, because deflationists typically think that any sort of issue, philosophical debate, or whatever that seems to essentially involve the notion of truth can really be formulated without it, because, after all, there's the deflationist thinks there's not much more to the essence of truth or to the meaning of the concept beyond this trifling equivalence that we mentioned earlier. So that's a beginning of an answer to the question. But yes, I think more to answer your question more directly, anti-realists, particularly old school Demetian anti-realists, sort of, almost verificationists, they think true belief is relatively easy to come by. You just apply whatever epistemic methods have been shown to work in the relevant domain. You don't need to do some sort of transcendental metaphysics and figure out whether your belief or judgment or sentence really maps on to some concrete chunk of reality that can be described somehow independently of thought and talk. Whereas the correspondence theory of truth is more closely affiliated with so-called realism about various subject matters, like the ones we've been talking about.
Have you already stated how problematic that is when we deal with scientific realism, which is at least in part based on empirical observation, testing, theory, application, and the correspondence theories of truth? Clearly, in a scientific realism talk, no one can deny that the Earth rotates around the sun. Then that gets problematic, because you can be deflationist about truth and say that, yes, truth is true in that theory, perhaps not universally true, but all we need is a pragmatic view of truth. That's a problematic aspect that we can get around without having any maximum 100% dedication to truth, as some of the points you're alluding to there. What about the aspect which becomes even slightly more fuzzier in terms of, say, the humanities and the social sciences? And obviously here we've got famous schools such as the Frankfurt School, people such as Foucault in the second part of the 20th century, which really, to an essence, say that truth, it is a power game. It comes out of discourse. Now, that is easier to say because there isn't as much independent, quotation marks per se, observation in the social sciences and humanities. Is that an issue for you, or can we simply just demarcate that again as saying that the humanities are always going to be far more subjective than any empirical science that deals with observational entities that are independent of human affairs? Is that a warrant classification? How do you deal with truth in that area?
Okay, good. Yeah. It's funny, I was reminded when you were posing the question that I co-taught this seminar once in philosophy and drama with someone in the drama department at Stanford, and she was scandalized to hear that we even bothered talking about truth anymore in analytic philosophy departments. She thought we'd outgrown that habit. But I don't know, I mean, speaking for myself, I tend to be, by default, sort of realist about most areas of inquiry, and I tend not to see a sharp, bright line between the humanities and the sciences, you know, because there are all sorts of borderline cases these days, and there are all sorts of interesting meta questions. I mean, what are actually philosophical questions about what experimentation is and what scientific data look like. And as you can imagine, these are issues that are getting hammered out nowadays in the burgeoning field of metaphilosophy, insofar as, you know, people often wonder where we philosophers get off drawing deep conclusions about the actual world on the basis of science fiction thought experiments and the like. To get back to your original question about the role of truth in the humanities, I think that there are inevitably going to be certain fields in which the facts of the matter in the field are constituted in part by our practices. So you can call that anti-realism, you could call it social constructivism specifically. I guess one helpful Google search term along these lines, if you're interested in seeing what analytic philosophers have done with this idea, is judgment dependence, which is associated with Mark Johnston and Crispin Wright. The thought is that the facts in some domains, what's an example? Maybe the facts about the colors of objects. So to take a case that's not clearly in the humanities, that's ostensibly more in the sciences. The facts about the colors of objects might actually be constituted by our responses to stimulation through the senses by those objects. I guess that's not really a case of judgment dependence. That's more of a case of what Johnston calls response dependence, which is a more liberal notion, a more general notion. But here's a case that I think Kit Fine likes to talk about. You might think that the facts about whether or not somebody is cool or hip, I'm in LA, whether somebody's a hipster, aren't sort of objective naturalistic facts out there in the world waiting to be discovered by the physical sciences. They're rather constituted in part by the right social group being disposed to classify the relevant person as a hipster. So if you can somehow get our judgments or our responses into the story about what makes the facts, then you've got the materials for a sort of anti-realism or social constructivism or whatever you want to call it. And I think it's entirely plausible that some domains, I don't know how many, but some domains of inquiry, like fashion, for example, if you want to figure out what the facts in fashion are going to have something like this, are going to feature something like this response dependence or judgment dependence.
Clearly, I think in the arts, everyone would agree there's a fair amount of subjectivity to it. But then again, in some aspects of the social science, they do actually use complex statistical methods akin to some kind of replication of the natural sciences. So then if it is, are you arguing truth because of the facts? Are you putting truth on top of the facts? So that's problematic. But having put all that together and given us some very good summaries, what do you think are the best theories of truth and why, and what, and some of the most problematic theories of truth and why, from your background and expertise?
Like I said earlier, I'm a deflationist. It's a pretty popular position among philosophers of language these days, less so among philosophers, full stop. And the view is something like there's nothing more to the nature of truth, the property, or there's nothing more to the concept of truth or the content of the word than this trivial-seeming equivalence between asserting that something is true and asserting that very thing. For a while, I mean, in Ramsey's hands, when deflationism went by the so-called, the label of the redundancy theory of truth, there wasn't really much of a positive story behind deflationism. It just looked like truth drops out because you can always rephrase any sort of basic truth description so that it doesn't feature the word. But in Quine's hands, we began to see some sort of positive points in favor of this position. So I think these points originated in Quine. I might be wrong about that, but anyway, that's where I remember them from. So instead of thinking about the word true, that expression from natural language, picking out or tracking the distribution of some real world property out there that we could study scientifically in principle, the deflationist focuses on what we do with the word. What's the point of having this expression in our vocabulary, especially in light of the fact that there does seem to be this trivial equivalence between truth attributions and the sentences to which truth is there attributed. And one of the things that sort of more contemporary deflationists have pointed out, starting with Quine, is that there's really, and I think Simon Blackburn talked about this a bit in his interview with you, there's this neat expressive function of our ordinary notion of truth that allows us to, in the first place, assert things that we're not in a position to summarize. And one sort of limiting case of this phenomenon is it allows us to assert an infinite bunch of stuff at once. So if you want to say that all the theorems of piano arithmetic are true, you can. You've just used the notion of truth to, in effect, express sympathy with or affirm each and every theorem of piano arithmetic, even though trivially there are infinitely many of them. A more mundane case might be, and this is, it's not obvious why this is the same sort of phenomenon, but take my word for it. A more mundane case might be a use of true that allows you to endorse or affirm something that somebody said that you didn't quite understand or fully hear, that you aren't in a position to repeat yourself. So suppose your friend is opining about the current political situation in Russia, and you know that he's an authority on the subject, and you want to express your solidarity with him, but he used these concepts from political theory that are just foreign to you. You're not even sure you can pronounce them. You're not at all clear on what exactly it was that he asserted, but you know that you want to agree with it. So it's very easy to do this if you have the concept of truth in your repertoire. All you have to do is say, whatever my friend Paul just said is true, right? And you get the effect of endorsing the thing that Paul just said without having to reproduce it yourself. That's sort of a neat trick. Along these same lines, so I should back up and say something a bit more general. What the deflationist is doing in opposition to the correspondence theorist is sort of changing the subject a bit or switching the question. Instead of asking what is the nature of truth, the deflationist really wants to know What's the meaning of the word, or what do we use this word for? Maybe en route to some sort of quasi-evolutionary explanation of why we have this concept in our repertoire. And so Rorty had some stuff to say about this, and more recently, I guess, Hugh Price has had some interesting stuff to say about this. He's got a really nice paper in the Journal of Philosophy called Truth as Convenient Friction that tries to explain some further reasons beyond the ones that I just summarized that are familiar from Quine, why we might want or need or anyway have a notion like truth in our conceptual repertoire. And Price's story in a nutshell is, I guess, that having the notion of truth, and maybe more importantly, the notion of falsity, which is sort of the opposite, it's a good notion to have because it allows us to start intellectual fight. It allows us to sort of indicate that we think whatever subject matter we're currently discussing, whether it's cosmology or politics or metaphysics, that we think the issue that we're focusing on needs to get resolved. We need to pool our collective evidence to get to the bottom of something. Now, you might not avail yourself of this expressive resource, the notion of falsity, if what you're arguing about is fashion or whether or not the movie you saw last night was any good. At a certain point, you might just stop arguing because you realize that you're not getting anywhere productive in the debate. But if we have the concept of truth, Price thinks there are certain discourses, certain domains of inquiry, where it's useful to use it not just for the deflationary expressive purposes that I was summarizing earlier, but because it sort of gets debate going. And debate is really important to human inquiry. When we butt heads over some intellectual matter, it forces us to sort of bring our evidence to the table, to try to compare our evidence with that of other people's, to synthesize that evidence, and hopefully, ultimately, come to a more, well, I'm tempted to use the word true again here, and maybe that's not suitably deflationary, but to come to a more, let's say, accurate, that's a helpful fudge word, to come more accurate conception of how the world is.
Okay, yeah, or a slightly more reasonable understanding of the word truth, which is another side fudge word for accurate.
Yes.
But I do see what you're saying there in terms, it's almost got a, it's obviously deflationary and got a pragmatist approach to what we can do with truth in everyday conversations.
Yes.
So that's all fine. And as you alluded to there, that is one of the principles behind Simon Blackburn's views on quasi-realism. See, now flipping the coin a bit, I'm going to give you some license to run rampant here. What are some of the worst views of truth that you think have been put out there or are currently out there now? What are some of the things that we can't be touching with truth?
Well, you're inviting me to be nasty. Let's see. Certain views of the nature of truth just aren't really on the intellectual agenda anymore, like pragmatism and, to a lesser extent, I guess, pragmaticism, the view that was associated with Peirce. I guess one sort of view that is talked about these days that I have a hard time wrapping my head around or have a hard time getting sympathetic to is this so-called pluralism about truth that Crispin Wright advocated in his book Truth and Objectivity, and then Michael Lynch has done a lot of work on as well. And here the idea is that what truth is different in different domains. So we shouldn't just talk about truth full stop as philosophical theorists. We ought to talk about truth in mathematics and truth in morality or truth in aesthetics, truth in science. And in each of these cases, once we factor out these different sub-questions, we may well see, according to this pluralist position, that the answer to the nature question, the answer to the question, what is truth, is going to look rather different from one domain to another. And one central motivation for this pluralist position, which I'll eventually come around to criticizing, is that traditional attempts to make good on the correspondence theory of truth seem to work pretty well when it comes to our thought and talk about medium-sized material objects, but they seem also equally difficult to generalize to other domains, like the moral domain or, to take another example, the mathematical domain in particular. So let's back up a bit and talk about correspondence theory again. The correspondence theory says that truth just amounts to correspondence to reality. And how that gets cashed out in practice is by saying that, look, you've got some claim or judgment, belief, assertion, whatever. It's got some structure. Say the claim is that the cat is on the mat, right? It's got some syntactic structure, that sentence that I just uttered. And what it is for the sentence to be true is for it to be possible to break up this structured claim into little bits, into syntactic units that you can map on one-to-one onto bits of reality itself, sort of real-life chunks of the world. And in this case, obviously, it's cooked up to help the correspondence theorist. You want to map the phrase "the cat" onto some, you know, conversationally salient feline, and similarly for the mat. So that's all well and good. This is a case ready-made for correspondence theory. Things look a little bit more awkward when you move, for example, to the mathematical realm, where it's unclear how exactly our terms for integers, for example, get mapped onto objects. Because it's independently problematic what these objects are, where they live. They don't seem to be material objects in the spatiotemporal nexus. They're in some, if anywhere, they're in some Platonic third realm. And our best theories of reference, our best theories of how little bits of sentences map onto little bits of the world, seem to work very well for cats and mats and books and tables and chairs and so forth. But as it happens, don't work all that well for numbers. And that the short version of the short explanation of why is just that our best theories of reference still to this day seem to involve some sort of causal connection between our use of nouns the objects that they purport to pick out in the world. And in the case of thought and talk about arithmetic, for example, there doesn't seem to be any causal interaction between us and that third realm. So this challenge to correspondence theory, to go back to what I was talking about earlier, is one main motivation for pluralism about truth. So the thought would be, maybe it's not so bad that we can't apply our theories of reference for words that pick out ordinary material objects to other domains like mathematics or maybe moral discourse. Maybe that's not so bad because it turns out truth in mathematics or truth in ethics is just a different property. It's not definable in terms of referential relationships that hold between bits of sentences and parts of the world. You have to tell some other philosophical story about the nature of truth in these domains. And then you have a host of theories to pick from, as we've talked about. You can go pragmatist. You can espouse some version of the epistemic theory of truth, where truth is just super justified belief. You can go deflationist if you want. And so, finally, to address your question, why don't I like this pluralist position, despite the advantage of sort of skirting the difficulties that traditional correspondence theory has faced over the years? It's just that it seems as though by cobbling together all these different theories of truth, you're taking on all of the traditional objections to each and every one of them, maybe skirting a few, but you're making your philosophical project much, much harder to execute, just because every theory of truth has what seem to be prima facie devastating objections that could be leveled against it. So pluralism just seems like a bad strategy insofar it's going to invite objections from all these different quarters. It'd be really nice if we could come up with some single unified conception of truth that applies across domains. And contemporary deflationism aspires to do something like that, precisely because, according to deflationism, the concept of truth is so thin, as people sometimes say. There's nothing to it beyond these sort of simple expressive functions associated with quantifying over arbitrarily many or infinitely many facts. So I'm not a huge fan of pluralism, but again, Wright and Lynch have said some interesting things in its defense. So that's the first thing that came to mind when you asked me to talk about contemporary theories of truth that I'm not particularly sympathetic to.
The pluralist visions of truth for someone like Michael Lynch, would it be fair to say that a negative review of that would be that they're attempting to hide the aspects behind the universal definition of truth by just adding chaos and confusion to it?
That would be that'd be a more pointed way of summarizing my pretty inchoate complaint. I don't think of Lynch as a confusion monger by any means. He's very clear headed. I mean, let me say one nice thing about the view. It has this sort of very elegant structural analogy to functionalism in the philosophy of mind, which some of your listeners may be familiar with, the idea that mental states like being in pain or even belief itself are in some sense multiply realizable. So octopus pain might be underwritten at the neurochemical level by something very different from human pain. And nevertheless, it makes sense to classify these things, so the functionalist thinks, under a single banner, pain, because there's certain functional or causal similarities between the states that underwrite the ascription in the two cases. And that's a nice structure. It's a familiar structure to analytic philosophers from traditional literature and the philosophy of mind, and it can be applied quite nicely to make pluralism about truth a bit more concrete and fully fleshed out. And the idea is that there is some very thin, almost deflationary notion of truth that applies across domains and that you can invoke to overcome some philosophical objections to pluralism having to do with how it's possible to argue across domains and argue validly across domains. But nevertheless, this very thin notion of truth is multiply realized in different domains. Different properties constitute truth. So insofar as the structure, insofar as the analogy to functionalism is useful, that's a point in favor of the pluralist position. But again, I do think that insofar as truth in any given domain is going to have to be one or another of the properties that philosophers have historically proposed as theories of truth more generally, conjoining various theories of truth in this sort of functionalist framework is only going to multiply the objections you have to face. It's not going to solve the problems.
Before I let you go, Alex, if you just want to tell us about your current research, any papers or books that you're working on in the area of truth.
Okay, so a couple of things. Me and my buddy Brett Sherman are co-editing an anthology at OUP called Metasemantics, New Essays on the Foundations of Meaning. And we haven't really talked about this a great deal in the interview, but one of the philosophically interesting things about truth is the way in which the notion of truth has been invoked in philosophical and contemporary linguistic semantics, the theory of meaning. So a lot of the essays in that book deal directly or indirectly with the role of truth in a theory of meaning. So that's one thing that I would encourage people to run out and buy as soon as it hits the shelves. I've got this, I think, forthcoming paper, maybe it's online already, called Keeping True, in quotation marks, a case study in conceptual ethics. And this is sort of a response to work of Kevin Sharp's at The Ohio State University. He's had a book out, I think, late last year called Replacing Truth, which is great and I highly recommend. So as a bit of background, Kevin and I and another philosopher I talk about in the paper, Matti Eklund, start from a very similar place. It's an idea we haven't discussed yet in this interview, but the thought is that the paradoxes surrounding the notion of truth, most famously the liar paradox, exemplified by a sentence like, "This sentence is not true," the paradoxes point up that there's some deep defect or inconsistency in our ordinary everyday notion of truth. The so-called inconsistency theory of truth associated with Tarski says that the paradoxes arise because some suitably comprehensive version of this equivalence principle we've been talking about is built in to our very notion of truth. And so the question, so from that starting place, the question Kevin and Matti and I are interested in is, well, if we accept inconsistency theory, what, if anything, should we do about it? Is the fact that, or the claim that, our ordinary notion of truth is somehow responsible for the paradoxes and therefore deeply defective, is that sufficient motivation to overhaul the concept, to define some new successor, similarly truth-like concept that we'll use for various ordinary and or theoretical purposes? Or, if we don't want to be revisionary, can you mount some argument to the effect that despite the defects in the concept, we ought to carry on using it as we always have? So I got interested in this stuff because Kevin has a forceful case to make that we ought to revise the concept, and he has a sophisticated formal theory of truth that constitutes one suggested replacement concept for the ordinary notion. For the purposes of linguistic semantics, and perhaps mathematics. And Matti, on the other hand, has historically, that's a bit of a stretch, he's not that old. Matti, on the other hand, has always been a little bit cagey about whether or not his version of this Tarskian inconsistency idea really supports revising truth, or whether it might actually be used to underwrite an argument to the effect that we should just keep the notion of truth as it stands. Now, actually, coincidentally, in later work, in a paper of Matti's that's appearing in the Metasemantics anthology I mentioned, he sort of argues against Kevin's revisionary line. drawing on some reflections about linguistic semantics. And I'm, in this paper of mine, Keeping True, as you can tell from the title, I also provide some considerations against this revisionary line and ultimately suggest that not only are there no pressing ordinary or philosophical or linguistic reasons to revise the notion of truth that we get from ordinary language, you can actually try to build a positive case in favor of keeping true, despite keeping truth, the notion of truth, despite the paradoxes, drawing on some details from Mahdi's discussion of inconsistency theory. So that's one thing I've been working on relatively recently, and be nice for people to look at that and email me and send me some devastating replies.
That's a really good question. I mean,